This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Manuel Noriega was a larger-than-life figure in the 1980s. The dictator ruled Panama for much of that decade until a U.S. invasion took him out of power in 1989. He was brought back to the United States, where he was tried for drug trafficking, racketeering, and money laundering. He finally finished his U.S. prison term back in 2007. From there, he was extradited to France for an additional prison sentence and then finally back to Panama, where he is currently serving a 20-year term. Noriega's fall is an epic tale, one whose root can be traced back to North Carolina and one man, Douglas McCullough. Douglas McCullough is now a judge on the North Carolina Court of Appeals, but in the 80s, he was a U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of North Carolina. Little did he know that a drug case he oversaw would end up derailing the career of a foreign dictator. Douglas McCullough is the author, a co-author of a book about the dictator's downfall and his role in it called Sea of Greed. And Judge Douglas McCullough joins us now on the State of Things. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about what was going on in North Carolina, because drug smuggling, apparently the North Carolina coast, pretty active back in the time when you were a U.S. prosecutor.
In 1981, when I returned to North Carolina from working on Capitol Hill and getting out of the Marine Corps and being a strike force prosecutor in Philadelphia, I had to acquaint myself with what was the biggest drug or crime problem involving federal authorities when I returned. And lo and behold, I found out that it was international drug smuggling, and we had all sorts of groups that were operating independently of each other, sometimes bumping into one another, smuggling marijuana from Colombia into this country.
And it turns out the North Carolina coast was a pretty friendly environment for that kind of thing.
Yes, if you're familiar with the coast today, it is much more built up than it was back in 1981. And in 1981, believe it or not, much of the coast looked like it would have in Blackbeard's day or in the Rum Runner's day. And we've had our series of smuggling histories and pirates operating throughout our historic area. But this era has kind of come to an end with not law enforcement, but condos on the beach.
Just development. It's not a good place to bring your stuff aboard. Sure. And you said it was marijuana. More marijuana than cocaine back then?
It was marijuana in bulk. And part of this is a historic thing. The anti-war movement had spawned a huge taste for marijuana, so we had a market. And Colombian gold was considered to be the premier crop that everybody wanted to have when they sold it. And there were very few patrols. There was very little coordination between other nations or law enforcement agencies, for that matter. And so it was pretty easy to get a boat, go down to Colombia if you had some connections, buy marijuana, bring it back here, and smuggle it in.
Did it get distributed all over the U.S., the Southeast? How far did it go once it landed?
Well, ours was not really for domestic or local consumption. It was going to Detroit, and then people would come in from all over the countryside. They would come from Maine, Michigan, Kentucky, Illinois, come into Detroit with campers or trailers and vans and trucks and load up in 1,000-pound quantities and take it back to where they came from.
Well, so the coast wasn't built up, but I-95 sure was in place, and that had a big part to play.
The interstate highway system was heavy. Heavily used, and at that time we did not have a lot of trained canine patrols on the highways. And if you had something smaller than a big tractor trailer, you weren't even going to go through weigh stations.
Well, so tell us about the particular case that led to the charges against Noriega.
Well, it started with a routine evening on a July the 4th weekend. Some sailboat people had rafted up their sailboats near the harbor in Beaufort to have a floating cocktail party. And two local Coast Guardsmen had to go out and make sure they had gone to mooring. And when they came out, they saw that the sailboats had left, but there were two lights coming in from the sea buoys that were out of the channel. And so they went to render assistance, and the first light came back into the channel, and the next one followed, and they realized these two boats were together. As they got closer, the first one was just an open cockpit runabout, and it had some strange-looking men in it. They've decided to follow them because one of them was dressed for Saturday Night Fever. Remember the era, the 80s, John Travolta and the disco era. And we have a Colombian.
And that should be a federal offense anyway. I don't know if it was in 81, but it should have been. Yeah,
it's an offense against taste, I can tell you
sure
that.
Is.
But he had on a silk shirt stacked heeled shoes, the bell bottom pants and gold chains, and was obviously not from here, as we say down east.
Right.
And these guys lied to him, but they didn't. They couldn't arrest him for that, and so they looked for the other boat, which was the trawler. And after an encounter with the captain in which one of the Coast Guardsmen heard a shotgun rack around, he talked himself off the boat. They went and got assistance and found 29,000 pounds of marijuana on board that boat.
So it was on board. They hadn't had time yet to jettison their cargo.
They had not gotten to their predestined offload site, and they were meticulous planners, but they just hadn't planned for the shrimp season opening up on the July the 4th weekend.
And what did the shrimp season have to do with that?
Well, Marine Fisheries is out checking your shrimp boat to make sure you had paid your taxes.
Wow. So that was the reason. I mean, they weren't even looking necessarily for smugglers, but because this was the time you wanted to make sure everybody was up to date.
Everybody's
more Coast Guard
up to date.
Patrols. Yeah. So they get caught, but the case really, they handled, there was a lot of evidence on that boat. And at least one badly dressed crew member. And yet the case remained stagnant for about 3 years. Is that right?
That's right. We had a number of leads. We identified people who had rented beach cottages at Emerald Isle. We bought boats with cashier's checks, all the types of things you need to prove a case if you just have a good witness who can link all this together. And we didn't have the witness. In the meantime, of course, our smugglers didn't sit still. They became very, very successful.
Well, how is it that they did they find the evidence on? I mean, wasn't that plenty to bring them to trial?
Well, it would have if we'd had a witness. The problem was we had no witnesses.
By
the time the Coast Guardsmen heard the shotgun rack around, to back up just a second and put the listeners into perspective, they realized that if they broadcast over the radio, the people on the shrimp boat would be able to hear that broadcast. We didn't have encrypted communications then. Didn't have cell phones, so they had to leave sight of the boat and go find a pay station telephone to call for backup. So they dropped a dime or a quarter into the payphone and called for assistance. By the time they could get back to the boat, everybody was gone.
Why were they worried that the shrimpers would hear their call for backup?
Well, they were still within shotgun range.
Oh, I see. But they were afraid that they would all kind of gather around to watch the festivities and then be collateral damage.
They were concerned about getting shot at that particular moment, so they backed away from the boat. And then they didn't want them to know, because they were hoping that at least the two people that they knew were on board might stick with the boat, or the boat might attempt to move and backup could apprehend some people. But that's not what happened.
So how did you finally get them?
Well, what happened is these smugglers, like I said, did not stand still. They smuggled a 39,000-pound load into Morehead City later, which was successful. Then they did a 600,000-pound load up the Mississippi River that was successful, which netted them about $50 million in cash that ultimately went to Panama. But one of the smugglers had an airplane load coming in at the same time the 600,000-pound load was coming in, and he wanted his airplane to land before the boat. And he held one of his employees accountable for preventing the boat getting in first because it would depress the price. Now, mind you, he wouldn't lose money on this load. He just wouldn't get quite as much. And he was angry about that, so he had this employee of his shot. And that became our witness, because he didn't die.
I see. So tell us what happens after that and how they're connected to Manuel Noriega.
Well, at the time, they had amassed this fortune of $50 million in 1982 dollars. If you can, that would be like $250 to $350 million, I guess, today. They had it in a house in Tampa, in cash, under shotgun guard, and with naked Cuban women doing the money counting. We searched the house and found the money counters all burned out and fried from having counted all this money. But, of course, the money was gone by then. They needed to put it in a safe place, and one of the smugglers, a guy by the name of Stephen Kalish, a high school dropout from Houston, contacted a Cuban who said he could make the connection, and lo and behold, he did. Kalish bribed Noriega on his first meeting with $300,000 in cash, and Noriega agreed to launder the money into Panamanian banks for 15%.
So this was their problem, obviously, was laundering. And the other thing was they must have known that Noriega was a guy who was doing this. He's in the business. We just got to make the connection.
He was in the business. The connection had established that to them. They were fairly confident that this was going to happen. They didn't know it was going to be quite as easy as it was. All they did is put the money in duffel bags on a Learjet, fly it from the Florida area to Panama, taxi over to the military side of the airport where DEA surveillance could not see them, and then they would be given a police escort to the bank.
Wow. So that made it pretty easy. And how did you connect with Kalish?
Well, when this individual who was their security man got shot, his nickname was Shine, who's now deceased, but Shine became our chief witness, and he knew everybody in the organization up and down. And Kalish had gotten in trouble in the Gulf Coast area, had an appeal bond on him, and by the time he implicated Kalish in this, the FBI was looking for Kalish because he was a fugitive, didn't turn himself in. And we got Kalish just before he was to fly back to Panama and never come back to this country.
Well, we will find out what happened next when our conversation continues with Judge Douglas McCullough, now serves on the North Carolina Court of Appeals, but did help prosecute Manuel Noriega in the 1980s, co-author of the book about the dictator's downfall called Sea of Greed. And our conversation continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with Judge Douglas McCullough, who serves on the North Carolina Court of Appeals, helped prosecute Manuel Noriega in the 80s, co-author of the book Sea of Greed. So we're at the point where you can now build a case against your smugglers here and have made the connection with Manuel Noriega, who's also breaking the law, laundering money, and we'll find out more of his involvement later. At this point, what's your instinct? Is it just to keep going with this trial in North Carolina? Or?
Well, obviously, I had some 60,000 pounds of marijuana that had been smuggled into North Carolina, some with the assistance of local North Carolinians. Most of the people were from away, as we say down in eastern North Carolina, particularly in Carteret County, where I live. But there was a good group of locals, including the mayor of Atlantic Beach, fitness trainer from that area, and a local restaurant owner, and a few other folks who were local to that area that assisted them with the offload site and some other logistics. So I had those folks. So I had all the other smugglers and the crew members and everything else. Unfortunately, Tampa, U.S. Attorney's Office, was working on kind of a cartel leadership type prosecution, and they wanted to prosecute for conspiracy, and they wanted to nudge us out of this case. And I kept saying, you can't nudge me out. I've got, in the parlance of our business, I have dope on the table and you don't. I'll prosecute for importation and you can prosecute for conspiracy and we'll work out who gets what when they come to court. So we both had Kalish as defendants. The problem I had is that Tampa didn't seem to want to hear what Kalish had to say. Their U.S. Attorney's Office wanted to offer him a deal where he would get 30 years. Well, that was the maximum under the statute if he just went in and pled guilty and got no deal at all. And his lawyers were saying he could implicate Noriega, but they said they didn't care. Kalish was such a big ringleader that it was of no interest to them.
So, and this actually, it's interesting. This is a big fight and a big part of your book, Sea of Greed, this fight between North Carolina, the Eastern District, and Tampa over jurisdiction and just what charges would be filed.
TV sometimes gets it right that these turf wars can occur. Usually they portray it as feds and locals, but it can be fed on fed sometimes. Right. And that's what we had in this case. So what I did is I got Kalish up here with his lawyers for arraignment, which is a necessary step, and Tampa could not block me from having him up here. And when I got him here, I took him out to Camp Lejeune, the Marine base, had the provost marshal provide us some security, and used the Onslow Beach recreational trailers that are rented out as temporary offices. And we finally got a debriefing with Kalish, in which Kalish implicated Noriega in his own words, not his lawyers, produced corroborative information such as airplane logs where he had flown Noriega around on his private jet, taken him out to Vegas so he could party with showgirls, landed him at Andrews Air Force Base on that jet, and other documents. And it just couldn't be denied that he, a high school dropout from Houston and major smuggler, and Noriega were very, very close. And that was on DEA, Customs, and FBI reports. Those reports went up through the system, and that's where Reagan said indicting.
So you, at that point, the Reagan administration was interested in this indictment, and you got the word from the administration. I mean, you're obviously a federal prosecutor.
It went directly up to the National Security Council.
And, of course, the Reagan, I mean, this is all very interesting because Manuel Noriega trained at the School of the Americas in 1968. So he's trained to be a U.S. operative. Of course, that school implicated in terrorist training when people went back to Latin America. That was 68. He's on the CIA payroll. He's on the CIA payroll when George H.W. Bush is director of Central Intelligence in 76. 1977, the U.S. Negotiates or signs the treaty negotiated with Omar Torrijos, who is Manuel Noriega's predecessor. So this guy is known to the security establishment in the United States. He's known. He's on George Bush's payroll. Right? George Bush is director of the CIA. He's an operative down there and becomes successor to the guy who signed the treaty. And now all of a sudden, the administration wants nothing to – the Reagan administration wants no more to do with this guy.
Well, I think within CIA, DEA, he received some awards for his cooperation, and he had a reputation as a man who could not be bought, but he could be rented from time to time. Mm-hmm. And they were happy to pay the rent so long as he provided them information on his dealings with Castro and some low-level drug smugglers who didn't have the contact to pay him off and bribe him. But for the true cartel people, he was already in bed with them. Yeah. And one of the things Stephen Kalish was able to tell us about, which is also in the book, was that he got enmeshed in saving Noriega's life from a rogue operation and also interfaced with some of the Cuban or the Colombian cocaine cartels. And so it made it very, very clear how deeply involved Noriega was in all of that. And I think some people felt like they had been played.
Bit of hubris, don't you think, to think that he'll only take money from us, but he would never sell us out?
Well, it may be a little short-sighted.
Maybe. And if you're the CIA, how come you don't know?
Well, that's a question I have. I was a Marine intelligence officer at the same time, and I would go to a class, which was classified at the time, and be told that Noriega was a friend of ours. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting there like, don't they read the reports that I'm giving to criminal defense attorneys in open court?
Right. So all of these questions are now swirling about as the United States, by way of the Reagan administration, changes its position and its attitude toward Noriega. You are now told, go ahead with the indictment. Tampa's still not wanting to hear anything about Noriega's involvement, right?
At this point, Tampa became more – once the indictment announcement was made, Tampa's attitude kind of changed. They realized that this wasn't going to go the way they had originally played it, and they better get what they could out of it. And so they also knew that Miami was going to be the site for the trial team, that we were to gather everything. By this time, I had developed two witnesses against Noriega. I had developed a witness by the name of Lee Rich, who was a Grand Cayman Island playboy and the connection to the Colombians. Well, Lee Rich was going to go to Jamaica to the wedding of Tommy Lee and Heather Locklear, who he was friends with. He had Miss Columbia on his arm for his date. And we got word of that through an undercover agent that our witness Shine had introduced into the Rich compound down in Grand Caymans and tipped us off this was going to happen. So we had the Jamaicans grab Rich. And when Rich got back here and he already realized that Kalish was cooperating, then Rich became. So I developed the two first non-Colombian, non-Panamanian witnesses to implicate Noriega. And I think that's really what made the decision go the way it did. They realized at the top that this can't be suppressed anymore and we can't rent him anymore. I think at that point they decided we have no choice but to go in this direction.
So how much support then did you get from the administration and from law enforcement agencies as you went forward to try to build your case?
Well, on my case with the local, my case was strictly going to be the local prosecution, but I was to turn everything over to that I had developed to the trial team that was going to try the Noriega case if and when it ever should arise. And so for a long time, it just kind of sat stagnant because Noriega was indicted, but he was not in custody.
What do you do in terms of the law? Were you breaking ground in trying to bring these international characters into our legal system, or were trying to get a sitting head of a foreign country to stand trial in the United States?
Well, under our law, Conspiracy is, of course, they say it's the favorite statute in the prosecutor's garden because it is so easy to prove in certain ways. We don't actually have to have the drugs. We just have to say you had the drugs. We don't have to have anything but witnesses who testify about events, and we have to have an overt act, one, that occurs in this country, and then anybody in the conspiracy is involved. So if I'm going to smuggle drugs into the United States and I go down to Colombia and meet with you, you're in my conspiracy and you could be subject to U.S. law. Now, how we get you here is usually where the problem is. Extradition, that type of thing.
So, and again, you're focused on the local smuggling crime that you were going to prosecute. Did you ever in your wildest dreams think that they were going to actually bring Noriega back to trial?
After the indictment and when he was just left alone and became much more radicalized with his contacts with the Cubans, I really thought he was just going to thumb his nose at us.
There was an invasion then in 1989. This is now under President George H.W. Bush, which he called Operation Just Cause. And when Manuel Noriega was taken into U.S. custody, but it was a complete military operation that brought him out of that country. Did that surprise you?
Yes, that surprised me that that Noriega played into our hands so much. And in fact, I was an intelligence officer at Marfor Land headquarters, and I was brought in to brief the commanding generals and admirals there as to how this all happened, because it kind of surprised them.
What was the and again, the justification was, look, this guy broke our laws. George Bush, who had been paying this guy when he was CIA director, now says, you know, he's become kind of a liability. And at the very least, because he was doing stuff that our own CIA couldn't figure out he was doing. He was in bed with drug cartels and that sort of thing. There were a lot of questions raised about the validity of that action, the idea that we would go in and launch a military operation to extradite the sitting head of a country. And, for instance, at the time, Congressman Ted Weiss, a Democrat from New York, who was very much in the minority in his opinion, thought that nobody liked Manuel Noriega. He was a dictator. He had been making his people very unhappy, and, of course, he was smuggling drugs. But this is Ted Weiss in the immediate aftermath of that invasion.
Well, I hold no grief for Noriega. He's a dictator, a despot, a drug trafficker. But what's important is what we are. We're supposed to be a nation of laws, not of personalities. And I think we violated international law. We violated our own constitution. The number of American and Panamanian lives that were killed, the number of people who were injured, was hardly worth the price of breaking our own principles in order to bring him back and put him to a questionable trial, which I don't think is justified under our laws.
It was Ted Weiss back in 1989. It might have been 1990 by the time he said that. Over 500 Panamanian civilians were killed. I think the U.S. lost about 23 troops officially. Did we go beyond the scope of international law to bring Noriega back?
Well, I don't think so. I think what happened was that, as I said, Noriega became more radicalized with the Cubans. The Cubans and Noriega people attempted several feints into U.S. territory. You may recall there were some incidents in a petroleum tank farm where Marines were shot, shooting at ghosts, according to the Army, and they were taken off the line. And then they got low-life camera images of these infiltrators and saboteurs trying to slip in there and create havoc. There were numerous military incidents that happened while George Herbert Walker Bush was president before the invasion. And I think the final culminating straw was when one of Noriega's goon squads took a naval officer, made him kneel in front of his wife and family in the streets of Panama City and shot him in the back of the head. And it was after that that the invasion was launched. So while it was a collateral benefit that the prosecution took place, I believe the precipitating events were brought on by Noriega's actions himself.
What part did you play in the actual trial of Noriega after that?
Other than preparing the witnesses and making sure that every document that we had that could be of assistance and everything that would be required under federal discovery rules was made available, I did not play a part on the trial team itself. That was strictly going to be Miami's show.
There's a lot of pressure, I would imagine, in a case like that for a federal prosecutor.
Yes, I think the federal prosecutor who actually tried that case ultimately became the acting U.S. attorney in Miami and had a very good reputation going into the trial. I'm sure it was enhanced afterwards just as a prosecutor, whether you agree or disagree with whether we should have had Noriega there.
He was convicted and served time in the U.S., and he's finished here. He was taken to France, and now he's back in Panama serving even more time.
Yes, that's right.
What was the sentence? The sentence here was?
I think his sentence here was close to 30 years, but I'm not sure. And there would have been some time off for that. This was prior to our grid sentencing, so he was probably eligible for parole. I haven't followed that closely.
So you grew up in North Carolina. You weren't born here, but you spent a lot of time growing up in North Carolina.
Yeah, my dad was in the Marines. We moved here when I was 7, moved away for a few years, and came back when I was 12. And I went to Swansboro High School and live in Atlantic Beach, not far from there now.
So you watched all those smugglers coming and going and knew that someday. Did you always – was the law always in the cards for you, always want to be a lawyer?
No, I really didn't get focused on the law until I was near graduation from college and thought of what I wanted to do next. And then I went to law school. And while I was getting ready to go to law school, my dad, who's in the Marines, came and said, well, you're going to go join the Marines because they'll defer you while you go to law school. And we had the draft back then, and the Marines were the only service to do that. So after my first year of law school, I wasn't clerking or building professional expertise. I was at OCS.
Well, and then you did military service and then went to law. Again, was it your ambition to become a prosecutor?
I got interested in criminal prosecutions after my second year of law school when I clerked at Maine Justice for some people and that were revising the D.C. criminal code and got involved in some of the issues that were involved there and thought that that would be an area of the law that I would really like to be involved in. So when I got out of the service, I contacted the gentleman that I had worked for, whose name was Donald Santarelli, and he had been a high-level Justice Department official, and he said I should go to the Strike Force program if I wanted to try cases right away. And I did, and I was assigned to Philadelphia, and we worked on organized crime cases.
And you were, while you were in the Marines, you were also practicing, right?
Yes, I was a judge advocate in the Marine Corps, but my last 2 years in the Marine Corps, I was an instructor in Naval Justice School, so I really hadn't been in the courtroom itself.
You were doing something that I fairly interesting, and I didn't know about it until we were getting ready to have you on the show. Apparently, the right of counsel was extended to people just recently when you got there for people who were charged with something less than a court-martial. Is that right?
Well, it was this, what we call the special court-martials, those folks who were prosecuted for what would be a misdemeanor in normal state law or federal law, had a sentence of 6 months or less, but they could get a bad conduct discharge. And that brought it under the requirements of Gideon versus Wainwright that they needed to have a lawyer. And so Congress had created a lot of legal positions that needed to be filled fairly quickly. And the other services were just saying, well, we'll just take seniors because everybody's subject to the draft back then. If you're a senior in law school, you can apply. Nobody else needed. And the Marines said, well, we'll defer you while you go to law school. And so that's why I ended up going in the Marine program. I like the Marines. I mean, it was in our family, but
yeah, but it's a much better deal.
But it was the best deal for me because I was just starting law school, and I would have probably been drafted out of law school. In fact, I saw my our county board director after I had gotten in the Marine program. Said you were smart to do that, so you were on my list.
Good move. Eventually, left the military, went to serve as a legislative counsel for New Mexico Senator Harrison Schmidt. Tell us about that.
Well, he was on the Senate Ethics Committee, and I originally started with the Ethics Committee. I was involved in the discipline of Senator Herman Talmadge of Georgia for financial irregularities. It's kind of like a trial all over again, since we basically tried a case in front of the Ethics Committee and was referred to the floor for discipline, and he was censured. After that, I went on the senator's personal staff, and I realized this is not what I want to do because this is lobbying, and everybody wants this little provision in the bill to take care of this, take care of that. We want money for this. We want money for that. And I really wasn't that interested in those kinds of issues.
That's interesting. So that's the those who love sausage and the law should never watch it being made.
That's true.
And you wanted no part of that. So what'd you do after that?
One of Senator Helms' legislative assistants was coming home to be the U.S. attorney for North Carolina in the Eastern District. And he said, would you like to be my first assistant? And so I did. And that's how I got here in the fall of 81. And the fall of 81, I tried the Wilbur Hobby case, which was he was the president of the AFL-CIO for the state of North Carolina that was charged in a fraud case against the U.S. government. And we tried him in December of 81. And so about 82, just before the smuggling event took place, was when I was really getting acquainted with what were the big issues.
We will find out more about those issues and the current career of Judge Douglas McCullough on the North Carolina Court of Appeals when our conversation continues in a moment. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Today talking with Judge Douglas McCullough, serves on the North Carolina Court of Appeals, helped prosecute Manuel Noriega in the 1980s, co-author of the book Sea of Greed. So let's bring us a little closer to up to date. 2000, you joined the Court of Appeals, which was an elected position. So you're kind of back into politics, right?
Yeah, I'm back into politics, but not the sausage-making type. I retired with early retirement from the U.S. Attorney's Office in 1996 and went into private practice for 4 years. And then I stood for election. My first election was in 2000. And I was elected to the Court of Appeals and served for the next 8 years on the court.
What does the Court of Appeals do?
The Court of Appeals is made up of 15 judges. We sit in panels of three, and we hear appeals in every case from around the state except death penalty cases and rate-making cases from the Public Utility Commission. All those two types of cases go to our Supreme Court, but everything else comes to us first, whether it's an automobile accident case, whether it's a murder case, or whether it's a normal civil dispute or a workman's comp case where you have been injured on the job, from other appeals from administrative agencies. It's a very, quite varied agenda that
we have.
Yeah,
it's a lot. So these are cases that have already been adjudicated once, now they're on appeal, and they can be that whole range. How many cases do you, as one judge, hear in a year?
I will probably author about 150 cases per year, as do each of my colleagues, and I will. That means I will participate in about three times that many judicial decisions, not counting things like petitions or other odd things that might come before the court. And everything we do is by written opinion, and to explain our reasonings and rationale, so we can also explain to the lower courts what was done right or wrong, and to the lawyers. And then if it's a 2-to-1 vote out of our court, the losing party has a right to take it to the Supreme Court. But if it's 3-to-0 out of our court, they can ask the Supreme Court, but they need not take the case unless they want to.
And do you have to take your cases, or can you reject the appeal?
No. We're assigned our cases, we are assigned by the presiding judge which cases we're to be the primary author on, and usually that works out. But if for some reasons we disagree, sometimes the opinion writing is shifted around.
So anyone who files an appeal gets the appeal. You can't reject it just on the face of the petition.
Oh no! If you file a proper appeal, you will get an appeal and an appellate decision out of our court. The only way you would lose your right of appeal is if you made a procedural error in filing your notice of appeal, and that's pretty rare.
And you can maybe redo it. So now it's 2000. You ran. You had to affiliate with a party back in 2000. You ran as a Republican. And now that's not true anymore. We don't run with party affiliations.
No, we don't. And I was reelected in 2010. I was not reelected in 2008, and I had a 2-year hiatus, went back into private practice. 2010, an opening came up on the court, and I ran in a most interesting race, the instant voter runoff, where you voted for your first, your second, and your third choice. I ran as a nonpartisan in both 2008 and 2010. And I won in 2010.
Yeah, right now there's legislation that would have return us to that affiliation where judges announce affiliation. Is that a good idea? Which do you think is a better system?
Well, I'll just speak for myself personally. I prefer the nonpartisan race, and I'll leave it to the legislature as to what they want to think is the best idea. You look at the party registrations, and one side might be slightly ahead of the other, but the big bulk of the voters that are going to make the decision are in the middle. And some might identify with the Democrat more, and some might identify with the Republican more. Some people think people like Republican judges more than they like Democratic judges for all sorts of reasons. I got elected twice. I really can't tell you, but I think that it makes it easier for a judge to appeal to more people if you're not running partisan. If people in your party know who you are, you're going to start with that base. The Democrats do it. The Republicans do it. And if you look at the Democratic website in 2010, they endorsed the person that I beat, who was a fine man. And I have no problem with him personally or his judicial philosophy. It's just I thought that I had something to offer to the people of North Carolina, and I wanted to put my name in front of them. This is how we get there. The Republican Party did not endorse me. They just listed the names of the Republicans who were candidates for that position because it was a unique race. So parties are going to be involved in picking judges one way or the other. Right. But how am I going to get elected to get 50-some percent of the people? I can't do that by being a partisan animal.
But so what do you run on? I mean, it's interesting because parties do have platforms. They have agenda. They have their legislative agendas. They want to get things done. That's not what we expect from our judges. And yet we need to make a choice. So you need to campaign. So if it's not on political or ideological agenda, then what do you run on?
Well, I've tried to run on my background and what I've done in life as a lawyer and let people look at the types of things I've done as both a prosecutor and my record and the fact that I've been a defense attorney and I've been a civil litigant and I've been the attorney for Craven County. We were the county attorneys for a couple of years. And with that kind of trial experience that I hope I bring something to the court, and I think each one of my colleagues has their own background and that's what they try to run on as well.
So right now, the judicial elections are publicly funded, which, you know, sort of in some ways levels the playing field and the amount of money you can spend. Right now, there's legislation that would eliminate public financing of those elections. Do you think that's a good idea?
Well, I can, again, only speak for myself, but I enjoyed having the public financing because I had to qualify for that. I had to go out and raise some money, but I didn't have to raise an extensive amount of money that anybody would think that would compromise me in any way. The most money I could ask for is $500. The governor can ask for $4,000 for the primary and $4,000 for the general election from an individual.
Each individual, yeah.
And so I'm asking for $500 at the most, and the average is going to be around $100. I don't think anybody is going to think that raising those kinds of sums is going to compromise somebody, particularly when you have to get it from as many people as you do, because it's a combination of a number of individuals set by the Board of Elections and a target number. And so the number is low enough and the individual base spread is wide enough that you're getting it from a wide variety of people. It's not like you're in the hands of one particular
right.
group or another.
So is there a good reason to change that, do you think?
Well, again, that's up to the legislature, and I'll leave the wisdom of something like that to them. But since the demographics of party registration seems to fluctuate depending over time, I'm glad that I wouldn't have to run after having run as a nonpartisan, to go back to a total partisan would make me feel more uncomfortable.
Well, and the public financing part of it, do you think that's a good idea?
Well, I definitely liked public financing. Some people were saying that when I got elected in 2000, I didn't show very much support because I only raised about $15,000, and yet I got elected. So I was carried on the coattails of the partisan sweep that was taking place in North Carolina, and it extended down to me, and therefore the rationale was that I was lucky to get elected.
That's an interesting theory, the idea that if you don't have a lot of money in your pocket, you don't have support, but that money also represents influence, which I would think you don't want to go into the pocket or the mind of a judge.
Well, I know there's been some horror stories in other states that you can't get a seat on the Texas Supreme Court unless you can raise $1.8 million or $2 million or something of that nature. And I know Texas is a big state, but that's still a lot of money. And some of our other states have seen similar situations arise, and North Carolina has been able to avoid that. So I'm sure there's going to be some vigorous debate over all of those things in the legislature.
You talked about your reelection bid in 2008, where you took your hiatus. You lost that bid. An interesting race, because you were criticized for supposedly saying that Republicans should vote for you because you would favor them in a court case about redistricting, which sounds a judge candidate shouldn't say.
I didn't say that about me. I was saying that I was speaking about someone who was running for the Supreme Court, and I talked about him being a fair judge. And then later on, I talked about important cases that would be coming before the Supreme Court or other courts, and I mentioned redistricting. Then the two got linked, and that was an unfortunate lapse. I think we have a Latin phrase for it in court, which I won't bore the listeners with. It was a slip of the tongue to put the two thoughts together, but it wasn't meant to say that you should vote for this person because this person is going to definitely vote in a particular way. I would never say that about anybody, and I don't believe it's true about any of my colleagues.
Is it, when you think about that, electing judges, I mean, is there, it is a fundamentally different branch in the sense that it is not, we expect that judges don't have an agenda, and we do expect that our legislators and our executives do have an agenda. Is there a better process? You think, well, Democratic electing, that's good. We don't want them appointed by somebody we don't like. On the other hand, it takes a lot of money to get elected.
Well, I just read a fascinating book that's a real history of this whole area that one of my colleagues loaned to me. It's called The People's Court, and it goes through the history of the selection of judges from the earliest stage of our country prior to the Revolutionary War, through the war, and through the various modern so-called reforms. And it seems that every body in society has an interest in seeing who gets picked as judges, interestingly enough. And a reform is usually in response to a particular incident that takes place in a particular state. And therefore, they decide they need to have a reform because thus and so occurred, and we're going to reform that. And so right now, I don't know the exact split, but a large number of states elect judges. And there's a certain number of states that appoint judges. There are some states in which the legislature appoints the judges, and that's our sisters to the north and south. Virginia and South Carolina, the legislators decide who the judges are. Needless to say, a great many judges are ex-legislators. They get paid better, too, so maybe that's a benefit. But some of the states, like Missouri, have what they call the Missouri Plan, and they have appointed, but those stemmed from the desire of certain people within the legal community to decide who sits on the bench.
Wender, you have served in so many different positions. As you said, you were a defense attorney. You've been a prosecutor at the county level, a federal prosecutor. Now you're a judge. You have seen this criminal justice system work from many, many sides. And the Racial Justice Act is under consideration now. The Senate just repealed that act. And, of course, the assumption is that, or the question is, if race played a part in your sentencing, should that be, can we use statistics to generate at least a new hearing about the sentence? And of course, the argument is that judges and juries and prosecutors in general aren't racist. They're not wearing hoods in the courtroom. And others would argue that when you look at the statistics, something's up here. There are too many disproportionate number of people of color who go to jail, who end up on death row, a disproportionate number of white victims whose death results in an execution. Are you concerned about that? That somehow, not in the hearts of prosecutors or juries, but somewhere in the system, color and race play too big a part?
Well, the Racial Justice Act deals with the death penalty, of course, and that's a Supreme Court issue, and
right.
I don't deal with those kinds of cases. The involvement of race, I think, in the criminal justice system is mainly a matter today of culture and education and money and norms. And the fact of the matter is that the black community has fallen behind the other segments of our society in economics and education, and they seem to be guided by a different lodestar for some of their young men. And that has led to some disproportionality in the criminal justice system. So, yes, I am concerned about it, but I don't believe it's because of racism within the system. There may be an individual case here and there that you can point to, but systematically, I don't believe it's because of our system is racist, but I believe that we need to do more to elevate certain segments of our society.
Well, and that's where some people say the racism starts. It's called the school-to-prison pipeline, where we notice elements of this statistically building in when you look at suspension rates, even when you hold apples and apples together and make point-by-point comparisons, it looks like a disproportionate number of people who are of color end up being expelled or suspended. The correlation between suspension and expulsion in the criminal justice system is pretty closely linked. And so there are those who would argue that that's where the injustice and the disproportionality builds in at a very early level. It's almost invisible.
I don't know if that's a question, but I'm more like a statement.
Right.
But I would say that, you know, part of that is also our criminalization of our juvenile justice system. Things that happened at school when I was in school, you'd get paddled.
Mm-hmm.
Now the parents would be filing a lawsuit against the person who paddled their son for fighting in school. If fighting in school in the second grade was an offense, I would have been in juvenile court. Today, fighting in school will get you sent down to downtown to the juvenile courts, and the school system says, well, it's in the courts.
You are about to take on the Noriega case again in a way, but this time through fiction. Tell us about that.
Well, I'm not going to do the Noriega story all over again, but I do have a second book in mind. I'm going to take a real-life woman who was a drug cartel leader, which is unusual, and try to trace some of her events and fictionalize them. But her life was one where she rubbed shoulders with rock stars like Joan Jett and other people. She went to the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon and got hashish from the PLO and smuggled it into the United States. But I'm struggling with the ending because I want it to end differently. In real life, she got caught and sent to prison. And for fiction, I want to make it a better story.
Well, you could have controlled that when you were on the other end. We'll look forward to the novel. Judge, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Judge Douglas McCullough, serving now on the North Carolina Court of Appeals. His book about the downfall of Manuel Noriega is called Sea of Greed, and you can go to WNC.com to WNC.org, I should say, for links for more information to Sea of Greed. Just want to let you know that if you were in the Greensboro area tomorrow, the TEDx event gets underway at 8 a.m. at Greensboro Historical Museum. We talked about it on a recent show. One of our guests is Daniel Herr, who was on our show a few weeks ago. We had a little oversight, in fact, an important one that we'd like to kind of correct at this moment. He's a nanoscience department chair at the Joint School of Nanoscience and Nanoengineering. That school is in a collaboration with North Carolina, University of North Carolina at Greensboro, and North Carolina A&T State University. They are the collaborators. That is the joint project. North Carolina A&T, also a big part of that project. We neglected to mention that in our show in Greensboro. We're telling you about that today. The TEDx event gets underway tomorrow, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.